Today at Reader's Corner, we present an encore edition of our talk with Emily Ruskovich, author of the award-winning novel Idaho. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our guest today is fiction writer Emily Ruskovich. Her debut novel, Idaho, centers on a mysterious and shocking act that fractures the lives of an entire family and looks at the influences and reverberations from that event covering a span of nearly 50 years. This June, the novel won the International Dublin Literary Award, one of the most prestigious honors in the industry and the largest prize awarded to a single work of English literature. Today is the second half of our encore interview with Emily Ruskovich. You can hear the first part of the interview on BoiseStatePublicRadio.org, our Reader's Corner app, or wherever you download your podcasts. Emily Ruskovich grew up in the mountains of North Idaho. She received an MA in English from the University of New Brunswick, Canada, an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and currently teaches fiction at Boise State University. In addition to the Dublin Award, her fiction has been honored with the O. Henry Award and has appeared in Zoetrope, One Story, and the Virginia Quarterly Review. Today's conversation begins with a question about how the state of Idaho got its name. It's a story Emily tells in some detail in her novel, and it's a fascinating one. You know, I've had a lot of local historians and political scientists on this show over the years, and none of them have ever addressed the issue of how we wound up naming a state sandwiched between Washington and Oregon on the one side and Montana and Wyoming on the other with the name that we call Idaho. And I had to wait for Emily Ruskovich's novel to give me the answer to that question. So tell us about Idaho lore, let's call it, in your book.
Sure. It was an exciting thing to do this research because I didn't do any other research really for the novel. This was the only thing that I, you know, was looking for primary sources on, and it was amazing to learn this history. And it's a very fragmented history, and the one that I give in the book is the closest I can come to what I think happened, and it's from a number of sources, but they were trying to find a name for the state of Colorado, and it was being debated in Congress, and there was this miner there who was a delegate to Congress from mining territory in what is now Colorado, and he was a funny man and a sentimental man, and not a lot else is known about him, but the name was being debated, and there was this little girl, and it was the daughter of a friend of this miner, and she was in Congress that day. She was just kind of wandering around the commons, and he was joking around with her, and he wasn't really paying attention to what everybody else was discussing. He was kind of bored, and he just was, you know, teasing this little girl. And at a certain point, she ran suddenly out the door, and he called out to her, "Ida." Her name was Ida. "Ho, come back to me." "Ho" just as an exclamation. And then he said, "Ida, ho." And the people in Congress said, "What did you say?" And he said, "Oh, it's my suggestion for a name." And they said, "Well, that's an amazing word. It must be a native word." And he said, "Oh, it absolutely is. It's, you know, I heard when I was in the mining territory, I would hear the Shoshone chanting this name, and it meant the rising sun. And it's a description of the way that the sun would rise against a mountain. And it was so beautiful. Everybody was moved, and it nearly became the name of the state of Colorado. And at the very last minute before statehood was official, some researchers, you know, figured out that this was not a word that existed in any native language or any word like it. He was saying, "Well, no, it's like Idaho," but there was no word that meant rising sun, and nobody was chanting it. And so at the very last moment, they pulled the name Idaho, and Colorado became Colorado. But the name didn't die. The word Idaho was so magnetic, and this man would repeat it in the mines, and you know, people had become very devoted to naming Colorado Idaho, and people were disappointed. So it traveled, and it ended up the name of a steamboat that was traveling down the Columbia, this magnificent steamboat, and people on the shore stopped in their work, and they watched it go by, and there's this name, Idaho. And so people began to believe that it was a native word and that they'd even heard the chant themselves. And years later, what is now Idaho was going to become a state. The name of the territory was being debated, and there was this woman who was an important woman. I actually can't recall who she was married to, but her husband was, you know, an important delegate. And she said, I would like the state to be named after my niece. And my niece is this little girl named Idaho, and she was born in the state of Iowa. And she's named after a Native American princess, because that's the story that she had heard. And that's it. Mm-hmm. And so it's Idaho, as best as I can understand, is named after a little girl who's named after another little girl. And to find in the story of Idaho two little girls, and this wasn't, you know, when I first started writing the novel, it was, the story was already there. It was about these two little girls that disappeared and are lost. And then to find in the story of the name, these two little girls who have been lost by history, who have no idea they're responsible for naming, you know, the place where you and I live, was such a beautiful connection and such a surprise. And I would say coincidence, but it was deeper than a coincidence to me. It was like when you're searching for something so hard, you find it. And it was a real gift to find that.
So is there another novel in Emily's life today, that is?
Yes. I've been trying to find my footing since this book came out. So right now I'm working on short stories. I do have a collection of short stories coming out in the next few years. So that's what I'm focusing on now. But I do have many novels in my head, and some of them that I've started and just haven't been able to step into yet. I'm just not quite ready, just as I wasn't the first time. Mm-hmm. But yes, someday soon I'm excited to write another novel.
Of course, you're going to have to balance that new novel against all your teaching responsibilities, and you're working with students, mentoring our MFA students in creative writing. That must be very exciting as well.
Absolutely. And teaching and writing go hand in hand very nicely. I don't feel like my work as a teacher in any way hurts my ability to write. I think it actually helps at having the structure and being with people who are also doing the same thing that I'm doing at a different level, at a different stage. And just recently I read the first graduate story that I've read here, and by a young woman that I taught years ago in Wisconsin, who just happens to be in the graduate program here. And it was wonderful. And to see how much she's changed since I first had her when she was a very beginning writer, and just, you know, just the soul and heart and beauty of the story. And it's just really moving to watch people grow. And I'm excited to continue doing that.
So publishers and editors oftentimes find a way to insert themselves into the author's idea of the title of the book. And I've heard so many authors tell me, yeah, well, my choice was, but the editors changed it. Was Idaho your first choice, and how did that happen?
Yes.
Yes, it was. Okay.
I was really devoted to Idaho. Right before the novel came out, it went to some kind of publicity committee, and the title did not fare well. It just didn't go over well because it sounded like nonfiction. It was confusing. It didn't seem like a novel. And at the last moment, my editor said it didn't go over well. My editors really liked the title, but they kind of started to urge me to add something personal to the title. And I tried, but it really broke my heart to think of it not called Idaho, because Idaho is the soul of the book. It just can't be separated from the people. And at the time, I had been given a cover that was not good. It was not an emotional cover. And I was really lucky, because as this discussion of trying to change the title was happening, another artist, my English publisher, came up with the cover that's there now, which is a beautiful cover. He's the same artist who did H is for Hawk. Anyway, the cover sort of answered the emotion that my editors were looking for, and it spoke to the title. And so suddenly Idaho seemed like the title of a novel, because this other artist had brought his vision to it and had given the cover, you know, so much life and emotion. I'm really, really grateful.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Reader's Corner. Today we're featuring part 2 of an interview with Emily Ruskovich, author of the novel Idaho, and a professor in the MFA program in creative writing at Boise State. I'd like to explore, if I could, the relationship that you had between Jenny and Elizabeth. These are the cellmates, right?
Yeah.
And again, you've explained your visit to the prison and your experiences working in a prison. Could you help us walk through how this comes about in your own mind and what role it plays in the novel?
Sure. Elizabeth is one of my favorite characters, and she's sort of when we first meet her, she sort of believes herself to be beyond redemption in a way. She feels that there's this little girl inside of her, the little girl that she once was, and that she feels like she's losing her. And memories of her childhood are sort of the only thing that's sort of keeping her whole, keeping her feeling like a person, not like just a murderer. And she just feels like the little girl didn't commit the murders that I committed. She's safe. You know, that was me. That was this other person. And so she has this other friend, Sylvia, and as a way of sort of escaping prison, the loneliness, they've kind of begun this fantasy life together in which they've always known each other. And they hang up all these pictures on the wall that make it seem as if they were kids together. And so there's a picture of Elizabeth when she's 9 next to a picture of Sylvia when she's 9. And this is sort of fun to create this other reality that wasn't real. And then one day Elizabeth has this revelation that she can't lose the truth of what her childhood was. She doesn't want to mess that up with fiction. And she suddenly feels like this little girl is being stolen from her by her friend. And this leads Elizabeth to commit another crime within prison. And she stabs Sylvia, not because she wants to stab her, but because she wants a new cellmate. And this is the only way to get one, in her view, is, you know, to get in trouble and be reassigned. But she doesn't anticipate that this will also lead to her losing her privilege to go to the school, the writing classes that are her sanctuary. And it does. So she has her writing classes taken away from her, and she's assigned a new cellmate. And this new cellmate is Jenny. And Jenny, who has killed her child. And Jenny, this mysterious and quiet, what Elizabeth thinks is a very pathetic person in prison. And Elizabeth wants nothing to do with her. But the worst thing in Elizabeth's mind is that Jenny has been given Elizabeth's spot in these classes, and it just rips Elizabeth apart. But Jenny doesn't want to go to school. She doesn't believe she's deserving of such a privilege. And so she begins going to school for Elizabeth and taking notes for her. And they live in silence together. That's just sort of their whole relationship is what Jenny writes in the classroom as notes. She's taking notes of what the teachers say. And Elizabeth is reading these notes and learning through Jenny. And together they're studying poetry in total silence. And it's through this very painful process that they become friends. Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth marvels that it's amazing that it took somebody who murdered her child to relearn love within herself. And Jenny has made something possible for Elizabeth that Elizabeth didn't believe was possible, which is this very deep love and friendship. And in a way, female friendship becomes sort of the saving grace of everything in the novel.
Mm-hmm. From your experience teaching in a medium security prison in Wisconsin, it sure does seem like that may have played a key role here in expanding on this relationship. You could have had Jenny go off to prison and we never would have heard about her again.
Right.
And yet you built that in. Do you think that had something to do with those thoughts you had early on in your life, as you said earlier, about prison and then your experience of working in one?
Absolutely. When I was a little girl, I somehow believed I would go to prison at some point. I really felt someday I'm going to do something wrong and I will go to prison. And it was so terrifying and, you know, somewhat of an obsession for me that I was afraid of doing something wrong all the time. I was afraid of hurting somebody accidentally or even intentionally, you know, and it was this, I was always aware of my own power, that the power that we all have all the time, that we have the power to hurt other people. And I couldn't bear that I had that power, that I could hit my little sister or something if I wanted to. And it was I was so hyper aware of it that it was a pretty crippling obsession for a while that I just didn't want to ever do anything wrong. And I felt in my heart of hearts that I was a bad person. And I think that's something that a lot of us go through at various periods in our lives. But prison was on my mind from a very early age. And so when I was teaching in prison, I just felt so much empathy for these criminals, as if I myself knew what it was like to do something that I could never take back. And I felt that I knew what they were going through, even though I didn't. You know, I haven't done something that could get me in prison, but I just felt so much for them. And it was really difficult teaching because there were a lot of rules, especially being a young woman teaching, you know, with a classroom of male criminals. And one of the rules was that you can't say anything about yourself, and that the prisoners, the inmates, weren't allowed to say anything about themselves either. So even a thing as casual as, oh, I grew up in Idaho, we were taught that is off limits. You can't do that. And it was such a challenge for me because as a teacher, I'm very personal. I don't really know how to teach without sharing myself all the time and without trying to get others to share. And so, especially because it was a class on memoir, which is about your life, you know, and they were also not allowed to write about what they did, and they weren't allowed to write about being in prison. And I stopped teaching there before I got to read much of their writing because it was, I felt that I was putting the program at risk because I was having so much trouble saying the right thing, you know.
That's almost an impossible task.
It was. And that, you know, I was working with very gifted teachers who were better at it than I was. And what I heard from the other teachers who got to read their writing a lot more than I did since I wasn't there long was that they wrote in metaphor. You know, they wrote about their pain and their situation through metaphor only. And just it was really beautiful and sad, but also heartening to see that there was a way of expressing these things that wasn't against the prison rules. And it was just fascinating to see that people who were capable of horrible, horrible things were also capable of writing with such love and regret. And everybody is so much more complicated than you could ever guess. Mm-hmm. That's what I came away feeling.
Well, I'm just fascinated by the extent to which an author's own life experience spills over into a novel such as Idaho, and that's one good example. The other may be the story you told about your father and his upbringing. Mm-hmm. And then when we get into the novel, there's this Wade who is Jenny's husband, and he's suffering from dementia. But you tell the story of Wade's family and upbringing, and help us understand. I think Adam was Wade's father, and yeah, he comes into the story. What's the purpose there, and how is that, in a sense, based on life experiences?
Sure. Wade is very much my dad. They look alike. They talk alike. At certain moments, they're standing exactly alike. But my dad, I'm so glad he's not suffering from a disease like this at all.
Right, right.
And you know, his father died, but not of Alzheimer's disease. But what is similar is just Wade has a vision of his life because he's seeing it in his father. You know, he sees his dad losing his memory. And because this type of dementia is so genetic, it's very rare and it's very genetic, early onset Alzheimer's, he just sees a vision of his future. And he thinks someday I will lose all of this. The moment that I'm living right now, this moment in which I'm seeing my father and feeling pain, someday this will be lost. And how will I know who I am when that happens? And, you know, I guess there is a parallel in my dad having a vision of his own future when he was a young man. And he doesn't mind me telling the story because it's something that he's worked through. And he tells the story himself as a kind of lesson when his stepfather was abusing his younger siblings, and my dad came home from school, and it wasn't even physical abuse that he witnessed. He saw his stepfather being cruel to his little brother, and my dad lost it and beat the man nearly to death in a bathtub. And he left that day believing he had killed his stepfather. He left him bloody in the bathtub, unconscious. And he went to school for the last day, what he thought was the last day of his free life. He went to high school and he remembers being in this classroom and his teachers, I don't remember what they were talking about, but I think it was, you know, English. I think it was an English class and about Shakespeare. And he remembers hearing sirens and he was thinking, they're coming for me, you know, in wow. a few minutes, this is the yeah. this, my life is over. And another man's life is over, and I have done a horrible thing. He saw this about to happen to him, and the sirens went by, and he was shocked that they didn't come for him, and he went home, and the man had gotten up, and he wasn't dead. But my dad just had this vision of what could have been, and that's why he felt he has to go and get an education, and just being haunted by this version of yourself that's awaiting you in the future, I think, is was with my dad all the time, and it's with Wade.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm continuing my conversation with Emily Ruskovich about her novel Idaho. So you mentioned early on, Emily, the readers who comment on your book and try to figure it out, and some of them even thinking that, oh, Jenny couldn't have done this, somebody else did this. I'm sure someone must have responded to the dementia issue in this book. And then, well, there's so many different directions that readers could go. But how did readers react to your book, those you've had a chance to communicate with?
I've been very, very touched by readers' responses. Often after a reading, when I'm signing books and there's people waiting to talk to me, more often than not, I get very overwhelmed with how open people are. And sometimes I choke up and, you know, start to cry because people tell me their stories. And I had one woman in Sun Valley after a reading. She came and got her book signed. And then she said, I wish you had found June. And I gave my usual answer, which is, I know I wish I had found her too, you know, but she's missing. And most families who lose a child and they're not found right away, most of those families don't ever find them. And so what I was writing about was this, what it would be like to live with this question, this terrible question every day that you just fill in with your own imagination, and how painful that would be. And I was explaining this to her. And then she said, no, I know my brother went missing. And, wow. And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. And she said, it wasn't until we found his bones, you know, many years later, that I had even a moment of peace. And she said that finding his remains 10 years later, I think, was the first time she was able to breathe. And it just plowed me over. It was so, so intense and open and brave. And I just remember sort of grasping her hand, and that's the most moving and important thing to me that's happened, and the most surprising that's happened in publishing a novel, is just people opening up to me and being able to have this access to stories that I never would have known. And people's compassion for these characters is, it just means the world to me, and that I can help. Or that my novel, which does sort of feel more separate of me now, my novel has helped people to talk about, you know, the things that have happened to them. And I've been really, really moved by how much people connect with Jenny. And one woman, I was giving a reading at a little library in Garden Valley, and someone just saying, I know how Jenny feels. She says, I haven't murdered anybody, but I feel sometimes like I have. I know how she feels, and I just want to take it back. And I think that's more common a feeling than we might be able to recognize day to day.
As you were describing that last incident, I wrote down the novelist as therapist. And, I mean, really, there's quite a bit of therapy going on here as you're talking with these people who have lived through experiences something like what you're writing about, and it makes me wonder how long it's going to take for the novel Idaho to get into social work classes and other coursework where students are trying to learn how to deal with and comfort people who have been through these kinds of experiences.
Yeah, that's very kind of you to say. I think that reading is very therapeutic, and you know, when you're writing, I wasn't thinking about how this could help others. I'm just thinking about the people themselves as if they're real people. But I mean, I think sharing anything is how we endure, and it's how Jenny and Anne endure, is through sharing themselves when it doesn't seem possible to. And I think art, music, and writing, and all of the different kinds of art that are in the novel, that the people in the story find ways of expressing themselves through. It's how they go on, and I think that's really important and very beautiful. And I'm so grateful to be able to be a part of that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Aside from Ethan Kanan and Marilyn Robinson, who you met or dealt with at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, who's out there today is the great writers who are on the bestseller list that you love to read and you respect and perhaps even learn from?
My very favorite author ever to have lived is Alice Munro, Nobel Prize winner,
sure,
in Canada. And I first read her when I was in college, and I read her on a bad photocopy, and so I didn't know she was a famous person. Her name was there, but because of the way it had been photocopied, I just thought she wasn't discovered yet. And I read her story, Runaway, and no story had ever moved me so much in feeling like this is what a short story can do. This is what literature can do. And I went to my professor, who was a wonderful writer, Dee McNamer. I was about 19 years old. And I said, does this woman know how good she is? and I was really concerned that she wasn't more famous. And Dee McNamer sort of laughed and said, I think she's doing okay. And I read everything that Alice Munro ever wrote except one book, which I'm saving for when I'm an old lady, because I want to always have something new by her. And I even got the opportunity to meet her once. I wrote her a letter and told her how I felt. We were standing on our doorstep, and she pulls up in a car. She was being driven, and I see her white hair, and I think, oh my gosh, I'm about to meet this person who has shaped my life in ways I can't even ever express, because I'd sound crazy. And she got out of her car, and I just shook her hand, and we spoke for maybe 3 minutes, and that was it. And I was glad it was only 3 minutes, because it was too much pressure to even think about what to say. You know, it was, I was very nervous, and I'll treasure it forever.
So yeah. For those of us who haven't read Alice Munro or much of Alice Munro, where do we start? What's the one book you would say we should grab and read of Alice Munro's?
Love of a Good Woman.
Love of a Good Woman.
And after Hateship, Friendship, Courtship, Loveship, Marriage. That's my second favorite.
Great. Mm-hmm. It has been a delight having you on Reader's Corner. Congratulations on Idaho, a Novel. And congratulations on your new post here at Boise State. We're honored and privileged to have you here as a member of the faculty of the MFA in Creative Writing program. We look forward to you sitting here one of these days in the not-too-distant future, either talking about your collection of stories or your next novel.
Thank you so much. You. It's been so wonderful talking with you. I really appreciate it.
Emily Ruskovich, thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Join us next week for our talk with Lindsay Hilsum about her book, In Extremis. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.